We followed the stream a few hundred yards until it, too, ended, the water flowing into a low opening in a hillside, the entrance to which was hidden by ferns and moss. The assistant knelt on the stream bank and pulled back a curtain of weeds, then froze.
"What is it?"
I whispered. He pulled a pistol from his belt and fired three shots into the opening. A chilling cry came back, and then a creature rolled out into the stream, dead.
"What is it?"
I asked again, staring at the creature. It was all fur and claws.
"Dunno," said the assistant, "but it was waiting for you."
It was nothing I could identify. It had a lumpy body, fanged teeth, and giant bulbous eyes, and even they seemed to be covered with fur. I wondered if Call put it there, if maybe he'd anticipated his brother's plan and booby-trapped all the shortcuts into his panlupticon. The stream carried the body away.
"Bentham said he didn't have any guns," Emma said.
"He doesn't," the assistant said. "This one's mine."
Emma looked at him expectantly.
"Well, could we borrow it?"
"No."
He put it away, pointed to the cave.
"Go through there. Retrace your steps backward to the place we came from. Then you'll be with the whites."
"Where will you be?"
He sat down in the snow.
"Here."
I looked at Emma, and she looked back, both of us trying to hide how vulnerable we felt, trying to grow a sheath of steel around our hearts for what we might see, might do, might be done to us. I descended into the stream and helped Emma in. The water was numbingly cold. Bending to peer into the cave, I saw daylight glinting dimly at the other end. Another changeover, darkness into light, pseudo-birth. There appeared to be no more toothy creatures waiting inside, so I lowered myself into the water. The stream rushed up over my legs and waist in a freezing swirl that took away my breath. I heard Emma gasp behind me as she did the same, and then I grabbed the lip of the cave and slid inside. Being immersed in cold, rushing water hurts like being stabbed with needles all over your body. All pain is motivating, and this type especially so. I scrabbled and pushed myself through the stone tunnel with a quickness, over slick, sharp rocks and low underhangs, half choking as water flowed over my face. Then I was out, and turned to help Emma. We jumped out of the freezing stream and looked around. The place was identical to the other side of the cave, except there was no assistant, no bullet casings in the snow, no footprints. As if we'd stepped through a mirror and into the world it reflected, minus a few details.
"You're blue,"
Emma said, and she pulled me up onto the bank and held me. Her warmth coursed through me, bringing feeling back to numbed limbs. We walked, retracing every step of the route we'd taken. We found our way back through the brambles, up the hill, past the waterfall, all the scenery just the same, except for the "this way" sign Bentham had set out for us. It was not here. This loop did not belong to him. We arrived again at the small forest. Darted from tree to tree, using each one as cover until we reached the place where the path ended and became a floor, and then a room, framed and hidden by a pair of crossed firs. But this room was different from Bentham's. It was Spartan, no furnishings, no poppy-laced wallpaper, and the floor and walls were smooth concrete. We stepped inside and searched the darkness for a door, running our hands along the walls until I happened to hook a small, recessed handle. We pressed our ears to the door, listening for voices or footsteps. I heard only vague echoes. Slowly, carefully, I slid the door open a crack, inched my head through the gap to peek out. Here was a wide, curving hall of stone, hospital clean and blindingly bright, its smooth walls toothed with tall, black, tomb-like doors, dozens of them curving away sharply. This was it. The White's Tower. We had made it inside the lion's den. I heard footsteps approaching, pulled my head back inside the door. There was no time to close it. Through the crack I glimpsed a flash of white as a man walked by. He was moving quickly, dressed in a lab coat, head down to read a paper in his hand. He didn't see me. I waited for his footsteps to recede and then squeezed into the hall. Emma followed, pulling the door shut behind us. Left or right? The floor ran uphill to the left, downhill to the right. According to Bentham, we were in Call's Tower, but his prisoners were not. We needed to get out. Down, then. Down and right. We turned right, hugging the inner wall as the hallway spiraled downward. The rubber soles of my shoes squeaked. I hadn't noticed the noise until now, and in the amplified quiet of the hard-walled hallway, each step was cringe-inducing. We went on for a short while, and then Emma tensed and threw her arm across my chest to stop me. We listened. With our footsteps silenced, we could hear others. They were ahead of us, and close. We rushed to the closest door. It slid open easily. We dove inside, closed it, threw our backs against it. The room we'd entered was round, walls and ceiling both. We were inside a huge drainage pipe, 30 feet wide and still under construction, and we weren't alone. Where the pipe ended and broke into rainy daylight, a dozen men sat on a pipe-shaped scaffold, staring at us, dumbfounded. We'd interrupted them during their lunch break.
"Hey! How'd you get in there?" one shouted. "They're kids," said another. "Hey, this ain't a playground!"
They were American, and they didn't seem to know what to make of us. We didn't dare respond for fear that the whites in the hall might hear us, and I worried that the workers shouting would attract their attention, too.
"Have you got that finger?" I whispered to Emma. "Now seems like a good time to test it out."
So we gave them the finger, by which I mean we put on the dust masks, wet from the stream but still serviceable. Emma crushed a tiny bit of Mother Dust's pinky, and we walked down the pipe toward the men, and attempted to launch the powder at them. First, Emma tried blowing it out of her cupped hand, but it just swirled into a cloud around our heads, which made my face tingle and go a bit numb. Next, I tried throwing it, which didn't work at all. The dust, it seemed, wasn't much good as an offensive weapon. By now, the pipe builders were growing impatient, and one had jumped down from the scaffold to remove us by force. Emma tucked the finger away and made a flame with her hand. There was a poof as Emma's flame ignited the dust hanging in the air, turning it instantly to smoke.
"Whoa!"
the man said. He began coughing and soon slumped to the floor, fast asleep. When a few of his friends ran to help him, they too fell victim to the cloud of anesthetizing smoke and fell to the ground beside him. Now the remaining workmen were afraid, angry, and shouting at us. We ran back to the door before the situation could devolve further. I checked that the coast was clear, and we slipped into the hall. When I closed the door behind us, the sound of the men's voices was muted completely, as if it hadn't just shut them inside, but had somehow turned them off. We ran a short way, then stopped and listened for footsteps, then ran, then stopped and listened, spiraling down the tower in stuttering bursts of action and silence. Twice more we heard people coming and ran to hide behind doors. Inside one was a steaming jungle echoing with the screams of monkeys, and another opened into an adobe room, beyond which lay hard-packed ground and looming mountains. The floor leveled, and the hallway straightened. Around the last bend was a pair of double doors with daylight gleaming beneath them. "Shouldn't there be more guards around?" I said nervously. Emma shrugged and nodded toward the doors, which appeared to be the only way out of the tower. I was about to push them open when I heard voices on the other side. A man telling a joke. I could hear only the burble of his voice, not the words, but it was definitely a joke, because when he finished, there was an eruption of laughter. "Your guards," Emma said, like a waiter presenting a fancy meal. We could either wait and hope they went away, or open the door and deal with them. The latter option was braver and faster, so I summoned new Jacob and told him we were going to throw open the door and fight, and to please not discuss the matter with old Jacob, who inevitably would whine and resist. But by the time I'd gotten it all settled, Emma was already doing it. Silently and quickly, she pulled open one of the swinging doors. Arrayed before us were the backs of five whites in mismatched uniforms, all wearing modern police-issue-type pistols at their waists. They were standing casually, facing away from us. None had seen the door open. Beyond them was a courtyard surrounded by low barracks-like buildings, and rising in the farther distance was the fortress wall. I jabbed my finger toward the finger hidden in Emma's pocket. "Sleep," I mouthed, by which I meant that rendering these whites unconscious and then dragging them inside the tower seemed the most expedient course of action. She understood, pulled the door halfway closed, and began to dig out the finger. I reached for the dust masks, which were stuffed into my waistband. And then a flaming mass of something flew over the fortress wall in the distance, sailed toward us through the air in a graceful arc, and fell splat in the middle of the courtyard, spraying dribbly blobs of fire everywhere and sending the guards into a state of excitement. Two ventured to see what had landed, and as they bent over to examine the flaming muck, another hunk came sailing over the wall and hit one of them. He was sent sprawling, his body aflame. From the smell of it, which was pungent and traveled fast, it was a mixture of gasoline and excrement. The remaining guards ran to extinguish him. A loud alarm began to sound. Within seconds, whites were flying out of the buildings around the courtyard and rushing toward the wall. Sharon's assault had begun, bless him, and not a moment too soon. With any luck, it would give us enough cover to search unimpeded, at least for a few minutes. I couldn't imagine it would take longer than that for the whites to repel a few Ambro addicts armed with catapults. We scanned the courtyard. It was surrounded on three sides by low-slung buildings, each more or less identical to the next. There were no flashing arrows or neon signs advertising the presence of Imbrins. We would have to search as fast as we could, and hope we got lucky. Three of the whites had run off to the wall, leaving two behind to extinguish the one covered in flaming excrement. They were rolling him in the dirt, their backs to us. We chose a building at random, the one on the left, and ran to its door. Inside was a large room suffocatingly packed with what looked and smelled like second-hand clothes. We ran down an aisle lined with racks of clothes of every description, from all different time periods and cultures, all labeled and organized. A wardrobe, perhaps, for every loop the whites had infiltrated. I wondered if the cardigan Dr. Golan always wore to our meetings had hung in this room. But our friends weren't here, and the Imbrins weren't either, so we tore through the aisles looking for a way into the next building that didn't lead back through the exposed courtyard. There were none. We'd have to risk another dash outside. We went to the door and watched through the crack, waiting as a straggler ran through the courtyard, pulling on his guard's uniform as he went. Once the coast was clear, we ran out into the open. Catapulted objects landed all around us. Having run out of excrement, Sharon's improvised army had begun to launch other things, bricks, garbage, small dead animals. I heard one such projectile utter a string of profanities as it smacked into the ground and recognized the shriveled form of a bridgehead spinning across the ground. If my heart hadn't been thrumming so tremendously, I might have laughed out loud. We made it across the courtyard to the building opposite. Its door seemed promising, heavy and metal. It would surely have been guarded had the guard not abandoned his post to go to the wall. Surely there was something important inside. We opened it and slipped into a small white-tiled laboratory that smelled strongly of chemicals. My eyes were drawn to a cabinet filled with terrifying surgical tools, all steely and shining. There was a deep hum coming through the walls, the dissonant heartbeat of machines, and something else, too.
"Do you hear that?"
Emma said, tense, listening. I did. It was sustained and chattering, but distinctly human. Someone was laughing. We traded a baffled look. Emma gave Mother Dust's finger to me and lit a flame in her hand, and we each put on our masks. Ready for anything, we thought, though in retrospect we were not at all prepared for the house of horrors that lay waiting for us. We moved through rooms I struggle to describe now, because I've tried to erase them from my memory. Each was more nightmarish than the last. The first was a small operating theater, the table armed with straps and restraints. Porcelain tubs along the walls stood ready to collect drained fluids. Next was a research area, where tiny skulls and other bones were connected to electrical equipment and gauges. The walls were papered in Polaroids, documenting experiments conducted on animals. By then, we were shuddering, shielding our eyes. The worst was yet to come. In the next room was an actual, ongoing experiment. We surprised two nurses and a doctor as they were performing some ghastly procedure on a child. They had a young boy stretched between two tables, newspapers spread below him to catch drips. A nurse held his feet, while a doctor gripped his head and peered coldly into his eyes. They turned and saw us with our dust masks and flaming hands and shouted for help, but no one was there to hear them. The doctor dashed for a table full of cutting tools, but Emma beat him to it, and after a brief scramble, he gave up and raised his hands. We pinned the adults in the corner and demanded they tell us where the prisoners were kept. They refused to say a word, so I blew dust in their faces until they slumped into a pile on the floor. The child was dazed but unhurt, He couldn't seem to generate more than a whimper in response to our hurried questions. Are you okay? Are there more like you? Where? So we thought it best to hide him for now. Wrapping him in a sheet for warmth, we stowed him in a small closet, with promises to return that I hoped we could keep. The next room was wide and open like a hospital ward. 20 or more beds were chained to the walls, and peculiars, adults and children alike, were strapped into the beds. None appeared conscious. Needles and tubes snaked from the soles of their feet to bags that were filling slowly with black liquid.
"They're being drained," Emma said, her voice shaking. "Their souls drawn out."
I didn't want to look at their faces, but we had to.
"Who's here? Who's here? Who are you?"
I muttered as we raced from bed to bed. I hoped, shamefully, that none of these poor wretches were our friends. There were several we recognized. The telekinetic girl, Melina. The pale brothers, Joel and Peter, separated so there was no chance of another destructive blast. Their faces were twisted, their muscles tense and fists clenched even in sleep, as if both were in the grip of terrible dreams.
"My God," Emma said. "They're trying to fight it."
"Then let's help them," I said, and stepping to the end of Melina's bed, I drew the needle carefully from her foot. A tiny drop of black liquid leaked from the wound. After a moment, her face relaxed.
"Hello,"
said a voice from elsewhere in the room. We spun around. In the corner sat a man in leg shackles. He was curled in a ball and rocking, and he laughed without smiling, his eyes like shards of black ice. It was his cold laugh we'd heard, echoing through the rooms.
"Where are the others being held?"
Emma said, dropping to her knees in front of him.
"Why, they're all right here," the man said.
"No, the others," I said. "There have to be more." He laughed again, his breath coming out in a little puff of frost, which was strange because it wasn't cold in the room.
"You're standing on top of them," the man said.
"Make sense!"
I shouted, losing my temper.
"We don't have time for this!"
"Please," Emma begged.
"We're peculiars. We're here to help you, but first we have to find our Imbrins. Which building are they in?"
He repeated himself very slowly.
"You're standing on top of them."
His words blew a steady stream of icy air in our faces. Just as I was about to grab him and shake him, the man raised an arm and pointed to something behind us. I turned around and noticed, camouflaged in the tile floor, a handle and the square outline of a hatch door. On top of them. Literally. We ran to the handle, turned it, and pulled up a door in the floor. A set of metal stairs spiraled into darkness.
"How do we know you're telling the truth?" Emma asked.
"You don't,"
the man said, which was true enough. "Let's give it a try," I said. There was, after all, nowhere else to go but back the way we'd come. Emma looked torn, her gaze traveling from the stairs below to the beds around us. I knew what she was thinking, but she didn't even ask. There was no time to go bed to bed, unhooking everyone. We'd have to come back for them. I just hoped that when we did, there would be something to come back to. Emma lowered herself onto the metal stairs and descended into the dark hole in the floor. Before I followed, I locked eyes with the madman and raised a finger to my lips. He grinned and copied my gesture. I hoped he meant it. Guards would be there soon, and if he kept his mouth shut, maybe they wouldn't follow us into the hatch. I started down the stairs and pulled the door shut after me. Emma and I huddled near the top of a narrow cylinder of spiraling stairs and peered down. It took a moment for our eyes to transition from the bright room above to this mostly lightless dungeon walled in rough rock. She gripped my arm and whispered in my ear,
"Cells."
She pointed. Dimly it came into view, the bars of a prison cell. We crept down the stairs. The space began to reveal itself. We were at the end of a long subterranean hallway lined with cells, and though we couldn't see yet who was in them, I had a soaring moment of hope. This was it. This was the place we'd hoped to find. Then came a sudden slap of boots in the hall. Adrenaline surged through me. A guard was patrolling, rifle over his shoulder, pistol at his hip. He hadn't seen us yet, but he would, any moment now. We were too far from the hatch to escape the way we'd come, and too far from the ground to easily leap down and fight him. So we hunkered and shrank back, hoping the stairs' spindly railing would be enough to hide us. But it couldn't be. We were nearly at his eye level. He was 20 steps away. Then 15. We had to do something. So I did. I stood up and walked down the stairs. He noticed me right away, of course, but before he could get a good look, I started talking. Loud and bossy, I said, "Didn't you hear the alarm? Why aren't you outside defending the walls?" By the time he realized that I was not someone he took orders from, I had reached the floor, and by the time he'd started to grab for his gun, I had already closed half the distance between us, barreling toward him like a quarterback. I hit him with my shoulder just as he pulled the trigger. The gun roared, the shot ricocheting behind me. We sprawled to the ground. I made the mistake of trying to stop him from squeezing off another shot while trying to give him the finger. I had it now, which was stuffed deep in my right pocket. I didn't have enough limbs to do both, and he threw me off him and stood up. I'm sure that would have been the end of me if he hadn't seen Emma running toward him, hands aflame, and turned to shoot her instead. He squeezed off a round, but it was wild, too high, and that gave me just the opportunity I needed to scramble to my feet and charge him again. I tackled him and we fell across the hallway, his back slamming into the bars of one of the cells. He hit me hard in the face with his elbow, and I spun and fell. And then he was raising the gun to shoot me, and neither Emma nor I were close enough to stop him. Suddenly, a pair of meaty hands reached out of the darkness, through the bars, and grabbed the guard by his hair. His head snapped back hard and rung the bars like a bell. The guard went limp and slid to the ground. And then Bronwyn came forward inside the cell, pressed her face to the bars, and smiled.
"Mr. Jacob! Miss Emma!"
I had never been so glad to see anyone. Her large, kind eyes, her strong chin, her lank, brown hair. It was Bronwyn. We stuck our arms through the bars and hugged her as best we could, so excited and relieved that we started babbling.
"Bronwyn! Bronwyn!"
Emma gasped.
"Is it really you?"
"Is that you, miss?" said Bronwyn. "We've been praying and hoping, and oh, I was so worried the whites had got you."
Bronwyn was squeezing us against the bars so hard I thought I might pop. The bars were thick as bricks and made of something stronger than iron, which I realized was the only reason Bronwyn hadn't broken out of her cell.
"Can't breathe,"
Emma groaned, and Bronwyn apologized and let us go. Now that I could get a proper look at her, I noticed a bruise on Bronwyn's cheek and a dark stain that might have been blood spotting one side of her blouse.
"What did they do to you?" I said.
"Nothing serious," she replied, "though there's been threats."
"And the others?" Emma said, panicked again. "Where are the others?"
"Here!"
came a voice from down the hallway.
"Over here!"
came another. And then we turned and saw, pressed against the bars of the cells lining the hall, the faces of our friends. There they were, Horace and Enoch, Hugh and Claire, Olive gasping through the bars at us from the top of her cell, her back against the ceiling, all there, all of them breathing and alive, except poor Fiona, lost when she fell from the cliff at Miss Wren's menagerie. But mourning her was a luxury we didn't have right then.
"Oh, thank the birds! The miraculous bloody birds!" Emma cried, running to take Olive's hand.
"You can't imagine how worried we've been!" "Not half as worried as we've been," Hugh said from down the hall.
"I told them you'd come for us," Olive said, near tears. "I told them and told them, but Enoch kept saying I was a loony for thinking so."
"Never mind, they're here now," said Enoch. "What took you so bloody long? How in Perplexus's name did you find us?"
said Millard. He was the only one the Whites had bothered to dress in prisoner's garb, a striped jumpsuit that made him easy to see.
"We'll tell you the whole story," said Emma. "But first, we need to find the Imbrans and get you all out of here."
"They're down the hall," said Hugh. "Through the big door."
At the end of the hall was a huge metal door. It looked heavy enough to secure a bank vault or hold back a hologast.
"You'll need the key," said Bronwyn,
and she pointed out a ring on the unconscious guard's belt.
"It's the big gold one. I've been watching him."
I scrambled to the guard and tore the keys from his belt. Then I stood frozen with them in my hand, my eyes darting between the cell doors and Emma.
"Hurry up and let us out," Enoch said.
"With which key?" I said. The ring held dozens, all identical save the big gold one. Emma's face fell.
"Oh, no."
More guards would be coming soon, and unlocking every cell would cost precious minutes. So we ran to the end of the hall, unlocked the door, and gave the keys to Hugh, whose cell was closest.
"Free yourself and then the others," I said. "Then stay here until we come back to get you,"
Emma added.
"No chance," Hugh said. "We're coming after you."
There was no time to argue, and I was secretly relieved to hear it. After all this time struggling on our own, I was looking forward to having some backup. Emma and I heaved open the big bunker-like door, took a last look at our friends, and slipped away. On the other side of the door was a long rectangular room cluttered with utilitarian furniture and lit from above by greenish fluorescent bulbs. It was doing its best impression of an office, but I wasn't fooled. The wall was spongy with foam soundproofing. The door was thick enough to withstand a nuclear blast. This was no office. We could hear someone moving around at the far end of the room, but our view was blocked by a bulky filing cabinet. I touched Emma's arm and nodded my head, "Let's go," and we began to advance quietly. hoping to sneak up on whoever was in here with us. I caught a glimpse of a white coat and a man's balding head, definitely not an Imbrin. Had they not heard the door opening? No, they hadn't. And then I realized why. They were listening to music. A woman's voice sang a soft, slinky rock song, an old one I'd heard before but couldn't name. So strange, so dislocating to hear it here, now. We slid forward, the song just loud enough to mask our footsteps, passing desks crowded with papers and maps. A rack mounted to a wall held hundreds of glass beakers, silver-flecked black liquid spinning inside. Lingering, I saw that each was labeled, the names of the victims whose souls they contained printed in small type. Peeking around the filing cabinet, we saw a lab-coated man seated at a desk, shuffling papers, his back to us. All around him was a horror show of random anatomy. A skinned arm with musculature exposed. A spine hung like a trophy on the wall. A few bloodless organs scattered like lost puzzle pieces on the desk. The man was writing something, nodding his head, humming along with the song. Something about love. Something about miracles. We stepped into the open and moved toward him across the floor. I remembered where I'd last heard the song, at the dentist, while a metal pick stabbed at the soft, pink flesh of my gums. You make loving fun. Now we were only a few yards away. Emma held out a hand, ready to light it. But just before we got within reach of the man, he spoke to us.
"Hello there. I've been expecting you." It was a slimy, smooth voice I would never forget. Call.
Emma summoned flames that shot from her palms with the sound of a whip crack.
"Tell us where the Imbrins are, and I might spare your life!"
Startled, the man spun around in his chair. What we saw startled us, too. Below his wide eyes, his face was a ruin of melted flesh. This man was not Call, he wasn't even a white, and it couldn't have been him who'd spoken. The man's lips were fused together. In his two hands he held a mechanical pencil and a small remote control. Pinned to his coat was a name tag. Warren.
"Gee, you wouldn't hurt old Warren, would you?"
Call's voice again, coming from the same place as the music, a speaker in the wall.
"Though it wouldn't matter much if you did. He's only my intern."
Warren sank low into his swivel chair, looking fearfully at the flame in Emma's hand.
"Where are you?"
Emma shouted, looking around.
"Never mind that," Call said through the speaker. "What matters is that you've come to see me." "I'm delighted. It's so much easier than hunting you down."
"We've got a whole army of peculiars on their way," Emma bluffed. "The crowd at your gates is just the tip of the spear. Tell us where the Imbrins are, and maybe we can settle this peacefully."
"Army," Call said, laughing. "There aren't enough fight-ready peculiars left in London to form a fire brigade, much less an army. As for your pathetic Imbrins, save your empty threats. I'll gladly show you where they are. Warren, would you do the honors?"
Warren pushed a button on the remote in his hand, and with a loud whoosh, a panel slid aside in the wall to one side of us. Behind it was a second wall made of thick glass, which looked into an expansive room engulfed in shadow. We pressed against the glass, cupping our hands around our faces to see. Gradually, there came into view a space like a neglected basement, jumbled with furnishings and heavy drapes, and human forms frozen in strange postures, many of which appeared, like the spare parts on Warren's desk, to have been stripped of their skin. Oh, God, what's he done to them? My eyes darted around the dark, my heart racing.
"That's Miss Glassbill!"
Emma cried, and then I saw her too. She sat in a chair off to one side, mannish and flat-faced, perfectly symmetrical braids falling down either side of her head. We pounded on the glass and called to her, but she merely stared, in a daze, unresponsive to our shouts.
"What have you done to her?"
I shouted.
"Why won't she answer?"
"She's had a bit of her soul removed," Call said. "Tends to numb the brain."
"You bastard!"
Emma shouted, and punched the glass. Warren backed his rolling chair into the corner.
"You black-hearted, despicable, cowardly—"
"Oh, calm down," Call said. "I only took a little of her soul, and the rest of your nursemaids are in top health, if not spirits."
A harsh overhead light flicked on in the jumbled room, and it became suddenly clear that most of the figures were just dummies. No, obviously not real. Mannequins or anatomical models of some kind, posed like statues with their tendons and muscles all flexed and popping. But in among them, gagged, bound to chairs and wooden posts, flinching and squeezing their eyes shut against the sudden light, were real, living people. Women. 8, 10, I hadn't time to count them all, most of them older, disheveled, but distinguished-looking. Our Imbrins.
"Jacob, it's them!"
Emma cried.
"Can you see, miss?"
The light flicked off before we could find Miss Peregrine, and now my eyes, ruined for the dark, could see nothing through the glass.
"She's there, too," Call said with a bored sigh. "Your pious bird, your wet nurse."
"Your sister," I said, hoping that might inject some humanity into him.
"I would hate to kill her," he said. "And I suppose I won't, provided you give me what I want."
"And what's that?" I said, pulling away from the glass.
"Nothing much," he said casually. "Just a little bit of your soul."
"What?"
Emma barked. I laughed out loud.
"Now, now, hear me out," Call said. "I don't even want the entire thing. Merely an eyedropper's worth. Less, even, than I took from Miss Glassbill. Yes, it'll make you a bit dopey for a while, but in a few days you will have fully recovered your faculties."
"You want my soul because you think it'll help you use the library," I said, "and take all that power."
"I see you've been talking to my brother," Call replied. "You might as well know. I've nearly accomplished it now. After a lifetime of searching, I've finally found Abaddon, and the Imbrins, this perfect combination of Imbrins, have unlocked the door for me. Alas, it was only then that I learned I needed still another component. A peculiar with a very specific talent, not often seen in the world these days. I had nearly despaired of ever finding such a person, when I realized that a certain peculiar's grandson might fit the bill,
and that these Imbrins, otherwise useless to me now, could act as a lure. And so they have. I do believe it's fate, my boy. You and I will go down in peculiar history together.
We're not going anywhere together, I said. If you get that kind of power, you'll make the world a living hell.
You misunderstand me, he continued. That's not surprising. Most people do. Yes, I've had to make the world a hell for those who've stood in my way. But now that I've nearly achieved my goal, I am prepared to be generous, magnanimous, forgiving.
The music, still warbling below Call's voice, had faded into a calm instrumental number, so at odds with the panic and terror I was feeling that it gave me a chill.
"We'll finally live in peace and harmony," he said, his voice smooth and reassuring, "with me as your king, your god. This is Peculiardom's natural hierarchy. We were never meant to live like this, decentralized and powerless, ruled by women. There will be no more hiding when I'm in charge. No more pathetic cowering beneath the skirts of Imbrins. Our rightful place as Peculiars is at the head of the human table. We'll rule the earth and all its people. We'll finally inherit what's ours."
"If you think we're going to play any role in that," said Emma, "you're out of your gourd."
"I expected as much from you, girl," said Call. "You're so typical of Imbrin-raised peculiars. No ambition, and no sense at all but one of entitlement. Quiet yourself. I am speaking to the male."
Emma's face went as red as the flame in her hand. "Get on with it," I said tersely, thinking of the guards that were probably on their way, and our friends still fumbling with keys in the hallway.
"Here's my offer," said Call. "Allow my specialists to perform their procedure on you, and when I've got what I want, I'll let you and your friends go free, and your Imbrins, too. They'll pose me no threat then, anyhow."
"And if I refuse?"
"If you won't let me remove your soul the easy and painless way, then my Hollows would be more than happy to do it. They aren't known for their bedside manner, though, and once they're through with you, I'm afraid I'll be powerless to stop them from moving on to your Imbrins. So you see, I'll get what I want either way."
"That won't work," Emma said.
"Are you referring to the boy's little trick? I've heard he's been able to control one Hollow, but how about two at once? Or three? Or five?"
"As many as I want," I said, trying to sound confident, unflappable.
"That I would very much like to see," said Call.
"Shall I take that as your answer, then?"
"Take it however you like," I said. "I'm not helping you."
"Oh, goody," Call said. "This will be loads more fun."
We could hear Call laughing over the PA, and then I startled at the sound of a loud buzzer.
"What have you done now?" Emma said.
I felt a sharp pulse in my gut, and without Call having to explain anything, I could picture exactly what was happening. In a tunnel below the Imbrin's room, a Hollow had been released from deep within the bowels of the complex. It was coming closer, climbing toward a grate in the floor that was scraping open.
It would be among the Imbrins soon.
"He's sending up a hollow," I said. "It's coming into that room!"
"We'll start with just one hollow ghast," said Call. "If you can manage him, I'll introduce you to his friends."
I banged on the glass.
"Let us in!"
"With pleasure," said Call. "Warren?"
Warren pushed another button on the remote. A door-sized section of the glass wall slid open.
"I'm going," I said to Emma. "You stay here and guard him. If Miss Peregrine's in there, I'm coming too."
It was clear there was no talking her out of it.
"Then we're bringing him with us," I said.
Warren tried to dart away, but Emma caught him by the back of his coat. I ran through the door into the dark and jumbled room, and Emma was behind me with the squirming, mouthless intern collared in one hand. I heard the glass door bang shut behind us. Emma swore. I turned to look. On the other side of the door, on the floor, lay the remote. We were locked in. We'd only been inside the room a few seconds when the intern managed to wriggle from Emma's grasp and tumble off into the darkness. Emma started to chase him, but I held her back. He didn't matter. What mattered was the hollow, which was nearly out of its hole now and into the room. It was starving. I could feel its gnawing hunger as if it were my own. In moments, it would start feasting on Imbrins unless we could stop it. Unless I could stop it. First, though, I would have to find it, and the room was so crowded with junk and shadows that my ability to see hollows wasn't of great advantage. I asked Emma for more light. She strengthened the flames in her hands as much as she could, but it seemed to only lengthen the shadows. To keep her safe, I asked her to stay by the door. She refused.
"We stick together," she said.
"Stick together behind me, then. Way behind me." That, at least, she granted me. As I moved past catatonic Miss Glassbill and deeper into the room, Emma hung back several paces, holding one hand high above her head to light our way. What we could see of the room looked like a bloodless battlefield hospital, deconstructed human forms scattered everywhere. My foot kicked an arm. It rung dully and spun away. Plaster. Here was a torso on a table. There, a head in a liquid-filled jar, its eyes and mouth agape, almost certainly real, but not of recent vintage. This seemed to be Call's lab, torture chamber, and storage closet all in one. He was a hoarder, like his brother, of strange and ghastly things, only where Bentham was organized to a T, Call badly needed a maid.
"Welcome to the Hollow's play space," Call said, his amplified voice echoing through the room. "We conduct experiments on them here. Feed them, watch them disassemble their food. I wonder what part of you they'll eat first. Some hollows start with the eyes, a little amuse-bouche."
I tripped over a body, which yelped as my foot dug into it. Looking down, I saw the scared-to-death face of a middle-aged woman peeping back at me, wild-eyed, an Imbrin I didn't know. Without stopping, I bent down and whispered, "Don't worry, we'll get you out of here." But no, I thought, we would not. This chaos of forms and mad shadows would be the scene of our death. Old Jacob ascending, doom saying, unshut upable. I heard something shift deeper in the room, followed by the wet draw of a hollow ghast's mouth opening. It was here among us. I aimed myself toward it and ran, tripping, catching myself, Emma running too, saying, "Jacob, hurry!" Call over the PA, mocking us, "Jacob, hurry!" He had turned up the music, driving, upbeat, deranged. We passed 3, 4 more Imbrins, all tied and struggling, before I finally saw it. I stopped, breathless, my mind reeling at its sheer size. The hollow was a giant, several heads taller than the one I'd tamed, its skull nearly scraping the ceiling despite its hunched frame. It was 20 feet away, its jaws wide and tongues raking the air. Emma stumbled a few feet ahead of me and stuck out her hand, pointing at something and lighting it at the same time.
"There! Look!"
It wasn't the hollow she'd seen, of course, but what it was moving toward. A woman, upside down and twisting, hung up like a side of beef, her black skirts blooming about her head. Even like that, even in the dark, I knew her. It was Miss Wren. Addison was hanging right next to her. They were struggling, gagged, and mere feet from a hologast whose tongues were now stretching toward them, slipping around Miss Wren's shoulders, drawing her into its jaws.
"Stop!"
I screamed, first in English, then in the rasping language the hollow could understand. I shouted again, then again, until it did stop, though not because it was under my control, but because I had suddenly become more interesting prey. It released the Imbrin, and she swung away like a pendulum. The hollow turned its tongues toward me.
"Cut down Miss Wren while I draw the hollow away," I said.
I moved away from Miss Wren while talking to the hollow in a constant stream, hoping to draw it away from her and keep its attention on me.
"Close your mouth. Sit down. Lie down."
It turned away from Miss Wren as I moved.
"Good. Good."
And then, as I backed away, it came forward.
"Yes, okay. Now what?"
My hands went to my pockets. In one, I had what remained of Mother Dust's finger. In the other, a secret, a vial of Ambro I'd swiped from the previous room while Emma wasn't looking. I'd taken it during a momentary lapse of confidence. What if I couldn't do this on my own? What if I needed a boost?
"Sit down," I said. "Stop."
The hollow whipped one of its tongues at me. I ducked behind a mannequin and the tongue lassoed that instead, lifted it up and flung it against a wall, where it shattered. I dove away from a second tongue, banged my shins on a tipped-over chair. The tongue slapped the empty floor where I'd just been. The hollow was toying with me now, but soon it would go in for the kill. I had to do something, and there were 2 somethings I could do. The vial or the finger. There was no way I'd be able to control this hollow without the boost in my abilities a vial of Ambro could give. Mother Dust's crushed finger, on the other hand, wasn't something I could launch away from me, and I'd lost my mask. If I tried to use it, I'd only put myself to sleep. It was worse than useless. As another tongue smashed into the ground beside me, I slid beneath the table and pulled the vial from my pocket. I fumbled to uncork it, my hands shaking. Would it make a hero of me? Or a slave? Could one vial really addict me for life? And what would be the worse outcome? Being an addict and a slave? Or being dead in this hollow stomach? The table was ripped away, leaving me exposed. I leapt to my feet.
Stop! Stop!
I shouted, taking small hops backward as the hollow's tongues lashed at me, missing by mere inches. My back